from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The first word on the 2012 economy as we put away the New Year's hats and noisemakers? It could be okay, say forecasters. Probably not great. Tragically, not enough to really bring back jobs. But okay, unless it all collapses under any one of a string of looming threats. What are we supposed to do with that forecast? Do we bury our pittance in the backyard? This hour on Point 2012 and your money. You can join the conversation. Do you have any left? A little shred of a nest egg? A little savings for a down payment or college or retirement? Where do you stash it in times like these? And if it's just a job you need, where's that coming from? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Evanston, Illinois, is Diane Swank, chief economist at Mesereau Financial, a Chicago-based firm that provides money management, brokerage, consulting services. Diane Swank, welcome back to the show. Great to have you.
Good to be here.
And joining me in the studio is Robert Posen, former chairman of MFS Investment Management, $200 billion under management for 5 million investors, former Secretary of Economic Affairs under then-Governor Mitt Romney, author of The Fund Industry, How Your Money is Managed. Bob Posen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Diane, we've heard these crazy forecasts that, you know, little fish in the sea hardly know what to do with. Let's put the potential unless it all collapses scenarios aside just for a moment. If we manage something like steady as she goes, I don't even know what that means. What does 2012 look like?
Well, if we manage steady as we go, we could get a little above 2% growth, which would be a slowdown from the sort of Indian summer we saw at the end of 2011, but better than 2011 overhaul. We are talking about a modest reacceleration in growth, which would be some jobs and some erosion of the unemployment rate, but not enough to really lift all boats.
Let's say it was 2% growth for the year, and let's say that was the average over the whole year. What might that make the unemployment rate at the end of 2012? We're just below 9% now.
Yeah, that gets to the complicated part. I'm looking for somewhere around 8.4% or so, maybe as low as 8.3. The problem, and the reason I say complicated, is much of the reason that the unemployment rate plummeted to 8.6% was that even though we were creating jobs, we also lost a lot of people. People dropped out of the labor force. Some 300,000 people just gave up and decided either to retire or not look at all. And we're finding more and more people today are at the end of their 99 weeks of unemployment insurance, and they're getting very frustrated and no longer looking for a job, which is not the way we wanted it to work.
So talk about a pain point. There we are, maybe a year from now, with unemployment hardly budged from these high levels. And that's in a kind of, as I'm hearing you, Diane, maybe a best case scenario where we have, you know, kind of just rolling along and no crisis. Bob Posen, let's just do a gut check on that growth projection. 2% if we don't have a great hullabaloo of some kind?
I think that's probably about right. We could be a little lower, a little higher, and I think that will bring the unemployment rate down to the low eights. But I agree with Diane. This is not a – we don't have enough growth here to really bring about lots of job creation and lots of economic happiness. I think given all the problems on the horizon that 2% and say 8.2, 8.3% unemployment, probably a pretty good guess.
Okay. Not good if you don't have a job. Not good if you lose a job. We'll come to what it means if you've got one and you've got a little something you're trying to put away to put your kids through college or buy a car or house or maybe retire one day. But before we go there, Diane, on the sidelines and not very far off the field here are this sort of string of horribles that could present themselves this year and really knock the economy, we're told, for a loop. Take us through those, the risk factors in 2012.
Oh, gosh, I've never had to be such a political strategist to forecast the economy. We used to think of the invisible hand of economics just sort of guiding things, and it's the market economy, and now politics matter more than ever. The political missteps we saw last summer with the debt ceiling debate, the downgrade of our credit, the two-month extension to payroll tax cuts and unemployment insurance, will that be extended further? I imagine it will, but the debate about it itself causes hesitation in the economy. The deal with our the trifecta of issues affecting the economy politically in the U.S. at the end of the year. The debt ceiling, a debt limit debate, again, could become an issue. The spending issues tied to that original debt limit debate, will they go through in 2013? Will they hit the defense budget when we hear Iran, you know, sort of shaking its sable, you know, sable rattling over in the Middle East? We also have the tax issue. Taxes will expire. Bush tax cuts will expire along with the other tax cuts that were enacted to help the economy, and that will all happen at the beginning of 2013. That's not a pretty place to be, and that's just the U.S. We, of course, have the European situation, which Europe is going into a recession. It is in a recession, going deeper into recession as we move into 2012. Not only are they a trading partner, their banks are in a crisis right now, and its euro zone is not able to defend the euro as a currency. We could have another financial crisis. That's a major iceberg that we hope our political leaders have enough navigational skills to avoid better than the captain of the Titanic.
And then there's China bust, if it should have a housing market bust or something bigger than that, I guess. And there's the Straits of Hormuz in Iran and even potential war.
This is the issue. And the Chinese issue is one that I think the emerging market issue is one that people often ignore with Europe, in that Europe is China's largest client. And as Europe slows, China slows. And they buy a lot of our equipment to develop their economy. And developing economies need our production equipment, things like Caterpillar, of those kind of things. And so there is a spillover effect. Even if we don't hit a major crisis, a slowdown in China alone would have ripple effects through the global economy, along with other emerging markets.
You know, a lot of investors these days have come through 20 years where it was just kind of hanging there and it would be all right. That is, until it all fell apart a few years ago. That's a lot of risk factors that you've lined up there for us, Diane. Give us some sense of their scale, because we heard the early sort of quick analysis for this year was could be fine unless everything collapses. I mean, so what's the downside? Are we talking maybe we drift back into recession bad enough, or even people still depression, real economic crisis? How do you scale these risks?
Well, the real risk is if Europe is unable, and right now things are quiet, we've got a couple days. This can change on a dime, as we know.
Yes.
But Europe is not is working on its problems. But this is a marathon they're running, not a sprint. And I hate to make the analogy, but the first marathoner was a Greek runner who died. So we don't really like that analogy. But they are running a marathon in Europe, and it's going to take time. And time's not something the market has a lot of patience for.
A muddle through marathon, But what's the risk? How big is the risk there? Could it really take down, stone cold depression kind of scene?
It actually is a risk. Our view is that we spend a lot of time in Europe, and when you talk to people within the Eurozone, the Anglo-Saxon view outside of the Eurozone is they're going to fail. And within the Eurozone, the commitment is, listen, we did this to avoid World War III. This is a 50-year project. We're not going to give it up. And for Germany alone, they lose over 20% of their GDP if the euro would fail as a currency. So we think there's enough incentives within Europe that they will actually keep it together and will avoid that. But there's still, a double-digit risk that they won't. Not a 30 or 40% risk, but I would say certainly a high risk that we see another financial crisis in the 15 to 20% range, and that's too high for an economy that's already been hit very hard.
Robert Posen, we're going to ask you how to invest in an environment like this, but first just take on these sort of risk factors and their scale. I mean, do you see, with everything we've already been through, the world economy, the U.S. economy, still kind of skating along potentially several big cliffs here?
Well, I think Diane has a good list of the potential problems, but let's put some probability on them. I think the chances of the euro falling apart totally as a currency are pretty low. I think what will happen is Greece might get kicked out of the currency before the currency falls apart. I think the other issue is just you need a unanimous vote for most of the stuff that the euro has done. And I think that it's likely that there'll be some holdouts. So what I see is the more likely scenario, not that the euro falls apart, but that they may have to kick somebody like Greece out, and it will get messy in the process. So I think that's and I don't think that will help the euro economy. I think it will muddle along, and I think they will be in recession. I think the other thing that's pretty predictable is that we'll have a political crisis in the U.S. at the end of 2012, because that's when the Bush tax cuts expire, and
This will be after the November elections.
After the November elections. That's exactly, you know, everything is geared to happen then. That's when the sequestration comes in because the super committee didn't do its job.
Where they just start lopping off percentages of budgets.
Well, somebody's going to, there's going to be a real come to
Jesus moment here.
Yes, because I think the, you know, you just got too many things going on. I don't think there's any politician who's prepared to have all the Bush tax cuts expire. Over half of them are for the middle class and the working people. But how that exactly will play out, so far every time there's been a chance to have stalemate in Washington, we've had it. And I believe that that's going to happen toward the end of the year. Hopefully we can negotiate this two-month thing. We'll get a payroll tax extension. We'll get unemployment extension, and we'll muddle through that. But at the end of the year, that's where I see the biggest probability of a real stalemate. And
who knows?
And who knows what will actually happen then?
We're almost up against a break here, but philosophically, let's just start there. What do Jimmy and Jane, America, with a little tiny nest egg, they're lucky enough they've kept one or two jobs here, they're trying to save for something. They'd like or need more than, you know, 0.02% return or a 1% return. Is there some place to go this year where you can get a return on whatever you've got?
Philosophically, on the broadest level, I think we have to that we should, and Jane and John should count on interest rates being quite low, minimal, for the next 2 years. That's what Bernanke has told us, and that's what I think we have to live with. So I think people really have a choice. They can take a little risk. We can talk about the types of alternatives they could go to and get a better yield. They can go into the stock market, or they can hunker down and get a very low minimal return.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about 2012, the economy, and your money. Diane Swonk is with us, Senior Managing Director, Chief Economist at Mesirow Financial out in Chicago, joining us from Illinois today, and great to have her with us. Robert Posen is with me in the studio, former chairman, now senior advisor for MFS Investment Management, big money under management there, senior lecturer at Harvard Business School, Brookings Institution, author of The Fund Industry, How Your Money is managed, wouldn't you like to know, and where a bunch of it went very likely in the last few years. And I want to get our listeners right in here with their questions. It is not easy to figure out what to do if you've got just a little bit of something to do something with. Mike in Needham, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to give you a piece of financial advice. It was the best I ever got.
Okay, let's have it.
You can make a lot of money when things are going good, but you can make even more money when things are going bad. The stock market is tremendously undervalued. I'm getting a better return with dividends than I'm paying on my house loan. This is the perfect time to get into an index fund, say the S&P 500. It is a golden opportunity.
Who gave you that advice that you're sharing with us there, Mike?
Believe me, Tom, I've been reading enough books on this. It is just absolutely golden. Another person would be Larry Kudlow on CSNBC.
Okay.
It's golden opportunity.
Golden opportunity. Okay. Let's pick that one up because we've got such a range. Bob Posen, I got a lot of people online here. Now, there's Mike, and he's ready to go in. He's making great dividends. He loves it. On the other hand, here's Jeff says online, you know, considering what people have lost and all the sort of funkiness that people now perceive in the market, people are becoming skeptical of the market itself.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of skepticism. But the first question for anybody is, are you able to invest in the long term? And by that, I mean 3, 5, 7 years. If you're really looking for the money to pay your mortgage and pay your school fees, et cetera, then you shouldn't be in the stock market. You've got to be short term. But and we'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah.
But if you do have a long-term approach to your retirement or you have enough money to invest, your caller is correct that the P/E ratio of the stock market is relatively attractive. But we don't know what's going to be in the bumps in the road. So the question is, how do you guard against short-term volatility? Well, one thing, as I'm saying, is you should be in there for, you know, a five-year perspective. But the other thing is to concentrate on high dividend paying stocks. And the S&P and the Russell 1000 have a higher dividend yield now than the than the 10-year Treasury has mm-hmm. interest rates. So that's a good cushion. But if you really want to concentrate on dividend-paying stocks, you shouldn't be really in the S&P 500. You should be in a fund or in an index that's geared just to dividend-paying stocks.
Okay, but even if you go there and that turns out well, you're still running the risk of the market taking a big oopsie-doodle dive.
Absolutely. But if you got a 3 or 4% dividend yield against a 1 or 2% yield, so you got a little cushion there, and if you're willing to hang on for 3 to 5 years, these PE ratios should come back. So I think that's the way you sort of need to judge the risk-return relationship, and you're hedging your risk by being in dividend paying. The one big caveat is there are high dividend stocks that are high dividend stocks because they're really done very poorly and the companies are in big trouble.
They're enticing some you of the, in with the dividend.
Yeah, some of the large banks are in that category.
Be sure there's some cake
especially
under the icing
European
there.
Banks.
Okay.
So you don't want to get into that trap.
Right.
Diane, I hear you there. What do you think about all this and the notion that the stock market is now really undervalued and a great buy opportunity, Diane?
You know, first of all, I agree 100%, you know, with the idea of being 3 to 5 years. I mean, I don't look at my daily returns on my stock market. I don't look at them even quarterly when I know it's been a bad quarter. I don't look at it because I'm a long-term investor, and the emotion is the wrong way to invest. And unfortunately, most small investors, what they do is they sell low and they buy high. They like the company of buying in a stock yeah. or in a market that's rallying rather than the loneliness of buying when it's low. So I think it gets to this point, but in a more broader economic terms, I think one of the things that's very important is it is amazing. No other country in the world has been able to get blood from a turnip in terms of profits other than the U.S. We have seen profit surprise consistently on the upside, even with almost no growth. We had a growth recession in the first half of 2011, and profits continued to surprise on the upside. Now, a lot of that cash is being held on corporate balance sheets. We'd like to get them to unlock that. We're in a bit of a liquidity trap.
Yeah.
We need to get that money working again. But the bottom line is that we are a country that does provide a lot of profits relative to wages.
Can you explain? Yeah, well, there's a lot in that sentence, but can you explain just
there's
the profit?
In that sentence.
And maybe it's self-explanatory when you put the wage clause on there, but explain how, in this low growth economy, how is it that corporate profits have been so incredibly high? How's that? Why?
Well, several factors. One is one we've been talking about where the risk factors are is international trade. Of course, companies that are multinational that have been able to rely on demand abroad have been able to do very well. We've also seen a lot of restructuring in places like the auto industry where sales are coming back, but they're way below the peak levels we saw before the crisis, but they've now downsized so much and reduced their costs so much. That includes some wages in there and pensions in there, but I think that has now made them be profitable as their sales come back, even in the U.S. So you've seen a lot of restructuring and a lot of wage constraint. I mean, let's face it, many people today have not seen a lot of increases in their wages, and those people that have gotten new jobs when they've lost a job are often accepting less pay than they did previously because the economy is not as strong, and that's helping to provide profits. It doesn't help as much to pay bills.
Robert Posen, is that wage constraint that a whole lot of people have felt, if you've got a job at all, chances are you haven't seen the kind of increases you'd like in there. Is that a kind of circuit breaker on better growth here? Because, I mean, after all, if consumers don't have money, what are they? You know, what's supposed to fire up the economy?
I think it does put a limit on growth. About 2/3 of our economy is from consumers, and I think they're pretty stretched from a debt point of view. They're getting a little better, saving a little more, but they don't have that much money to throw around. I think the key to economic growth in the U.S. is getting, as Diane says, the cash off the balance sheet of companies and into investments. That's the stimulus. That's where the catalyst is. There's more cash on the balance sheets of U.S. companies than we've ever seen before. And I think many of them are gun-shy for two reasons. One is they've seen what's happened in the last few years. They don't want to be caught in a bad liquidity situation.
Right.
And second of all, they're disturbed by the lack of political decision-making, the lack of a clear guidance here. I mean, it is – if you're a business person and thinking, well, am I going to build this plant? Am I going to expand, et cetera? And then you see a two-month decision in Congress, it doesn't give you the feeling like we're really on a good glide path. It feels like it's a pretty rocky road and we're going to have a crisis every few months. That's not good for a long-term
plan.
Who
knows what's around that corner, Diane?
I'll go one more step on that, and I think, many people, at the end of the day, if the economy is growing 6-8%, all this wouldn't matter because that money would be redeployed and we wouldn't care about the political gridlock. That would be normal.
Sure, of course, but that's a different planet.
That's a different planet, and it's not one that we're anywhere near close to right now. And I think one of the issues that really comes down to is when our government quality of our debt was downgraded, it didn't have any effect on government debt, which didn't put any discipline on the lawmakers in Washington to come to more agreement and less gridlock. But it did have reciprocal and sort of ripple effects for the economy to less less quality credit out
right
there. So anything that wasn't AAA, things that were high yield, their spreads widened. What it meant was a lot of companies had harder access, getting access to credit in the wake of that event. And so the ripple effects, we sort of ignore. I hear a lot of people say, well, you know, gridlock doesn't matter. Gridlock's good. If I hear that again, I'm going to, you know, sort of, that drives me crazy. Gridlock is bad right now. And I think we agree about that. But I think, you know, the ripple effects, people are ignoring that it did have some measurable effects on the functioning of credit markets, and that ultimately, as we all know, we all had to learn it the hard way. Credit is imperative to an economy that grows and can make bets on its future. Of course, there was too much credit expended. Now we've got a situation where we've got cash we won't even take off our balance sheet and spend, and that is really important. You need to make bets on your future.
Yeah, sure. And it's still sitting there after all these now years in this trough. Let's go to where people are trying to make decisions here. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Leon's calling. Hi, Leon, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Yes, sir.
Quick question. I'm 74 years old. I have about $115,000 in my 401, I guess it is.
Yep.
I owe $92,000 on my mortgage, and I was just wondering, should I continue to just pay on a monthly basis, 23 years left on the mortgage, or should I try to take my money and my savings and pay off my mortgage?
Do you know the interest rate on your mortgage, Leon?
It's about 6 1/8.
Six and an eighth, and you got $115,000 in a 401k and $92,000 remaining on that mortgage, 74 years old. Bob Posen, what's your advice?
Well, I think the first thing to do is go and see where they get your mortgage refinanced. These days for a 20-year mortgage, if your mortgage is less than the value of your house, you should be able to get a 4% rate, a 3% rate. So that's the most critical thing that you need to do.
Hey,
is
Leon,
to get
have
your
you
mortgage down.
Have you tried that, Leon?
I am planning to do that. My question really is my 401 is not insured. So I just wondered about the security of just continuing to go in that direction, or would I be better off to pay my house
off? Well, now, this comes to the nub of it, because there's so much uncertainty now. Here he's sitting with a 401k and just worried that that could blow away. I mean, a lot of people have seen money go away, so would he be better off actually owning the house outright? At least then he's got a material piece of property.
I think the answer is probably not. He can probably get, assuming if he's held the house for that long, that the mortgage is going to be quite a bit below the value of the house. He can get a much lower monthly payment on his mortgage by refinancing, and he should do that. The second is he ought to look at assuming he has enough liquidity to handle that mortgage payment, which I'm assuming.
Yep. Yep.
Then he's better off keeping his 401k invested. If he takes it out now, he's going to have a big tax bill. And second of all, he's going to lose the chance for long term appreciation. So if I were him, I would get his mortgage down low and get his mortgage payments, and then he'll be able to keep his 401k invested.
And,
but
and
he needs to have a 3 to 5 year time frame.
Well, 74, good.
And to be in a, you know,
What do you do with $115,000 401k?
I would put it in an index fund, and
you would, you know, in the stock market.
Yeah, I put it in a broadly diversified index fund, assuming he has enough liquidity to handle his monthly payments and his activities in terms of living. If he doesn't, the next best would be to be in a balanced fund. A balanced fund, which would be roughly 50 or 60% in the diversified stocks and 40, 50% in bonds. So that would be a more conservative approach if he was worried about year-to-year volatility.
Now, a lot of people may not have the nerve to do this anymore, Bob. I mean, they've seen what's happened to their, you know, their whatever
they
got
have,
over the last three or four years.
If they don't have nerve enough to – actually, if you look at balanced funds over a long period of time, if you don't want to deal with year-to-year volatility, balanced funds gives you the best risk-return relationship that you can get, because generally bond markets rally when stock markets go down. If you looked at 2011, your bond returns were quite good.
Somewhere,
as the stock market were minimal. There's that normal balance. And most people who have looked at this over time saying that somewhere in the 50-50 range, 55-45 range, 60-40, that will give you a lower
return volatility.
You know, your aggregate returns are reasonable.
Diane, you know, you say if you want to be in the stock market, you got to have this 3 to 5 year patience, readiness to wait. But a lot of people, if they look back over the last 3 to 5 years, are not going to be very happy with what they see. Is there a reason to think that the next 3 to 5 are going to be better with all the turmoil?
Can I just jump in and say one thing? Well, think about where we were in March in 2009.
The
stock market had gone way down.
Was it like 7,000 or something
in
the Dow?
The market was way down. Lots of people retail investors pulled out their money.
Yeah.
They missed the biggest stock rally of all time.
That's right.
And the reality, and Diane and I know this, is there's no way, no one can tell you the timing of when that rally is going to occur.
No. And if they do, they're lying to you. I mean, you know, we're both looking at the markets every day. I have to look at the markets every day, which is a hard thing to do because my view is much more broad.
Right.
As is, you know, we're both looking at a broad, long-term stuff, and the noise you hear every day is not what you want to be in, and also can be pretty, it can be pretty rough when you have things like almost 1,000-point rally or 1,000-point drop in a day. It's not a fun thing to do. But if I could predict it, gosh, I'd own my own island somewhere and just get out of this, right? And anybody who says they can predict it can't. But the reality is that there are some times when you know, in that March of 2009, you had to believe we were in 1936. And if you didn't believe
we were over the hump, even though it wasn't good yet.
No, it went into another recession.
Oh, I mean, okay.
And I think that's what you had. We had a Great Depression, and we stumbled again.
Again.
We had to believe that we were about to go down again with all the policies that were in play, including a Federal Reserve chairman who was an expert on the Great Depression, trying to do everything in their power to avert a repeat of the 1930s.
Right.
And I took faith in that at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you have to, that's when the only policymakers that I know in Washington that are truly, and I know people don't like the Fed. They are my friends. I like the Fed. I don't always agree with what they do. And some members of the Fed don't agree with each other. But these are people that sit every day thinking about only one thing, not politics, but the economy.
But we know that they can't necessarily save or fix it. Here's a question. John writes.
There's a lot to stem the
blood. Now, we see that. Point taken. Ben Bernanke, he'd made it his life study, and he stepped in at that time. And if you stayed in when the market was that low, you were glad a year later. Bob, John asks, he says, Tom, please ask Robert Posen about mutual fund fees. We're now at a point where the typical fund fees are about 2%. We're also 10 years into a zero return market with looking forward maybe 2% GDP, 2% dividends, 4% expect market return. Mutual fund management will then take half of their customers' returns in fees. Why should anybody be in that game anymore?
I'm afraid to say that he's not correct. The average mutual fund fee is not 2%. The average mutual fund fee for stock funds actively managed probably about 1% for bond funds, money market funds below half of 1%.
But if you really worry, a lot of them, it hurts if you're not making a return.
Yeah, but if you really want low fees, there you can go to index funds or you can go to exchange traded funds. Stay with the broadly diversified indexes. That's the right answer for you if that's what you're geared to. But I do think that there are ways to get better yield. What we've been talking about is your risk-return relationship.
Right.
If you feel like you don't want to be in the stock market at all, I guess I'm suggesting the first thing you ought to think about is a balanced fund, which gives you some exposure to the stock market but gives you less volatility. The second is there are a series of vehicles that will give you higher yield, but there is some credit risk involved.
Hold it there if you would, Bob. We'll come back to that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking about 2012 and your money. If you've got a job, if you're lucky enough to have some, and we know behind all this lies the issue of unemployment itself and what a lot of people have lost in these last few years, whether that's from a lost job or a lost home or equity in that home. You can join us in this hour. What's your question for our money team today? How do you earn more than, I don't know, 2% these days and sleep at night? What's your money strategy in these weird times? Are you tempted to buy real estate now? Are you still burned, still suffering? Diane Swonk is with us in Evanston, Illinois, Senior Managing Director, Chief Economist at Mesirow Financial. Robert Posen is with us, former chairman of MFS Investment Management, author of The Fund Industry. Bob, you were about to give us that golden opportunity for higher yields. How, where, what?
Well, I think we have to think about the yield environment and realize that with the 10-year Treasury below 2%, the 1-year Treasury at a trivial number, a lot of people are saying, well, I don't want to be in the stock market. How can I get a better yield? And the answer is you can get a better yield, but you've got to take a little credit risk. And the two two big categories mm-hmm. are emerging market debt and high yield debt. If you're going to go into these areas, you ought to be in a diversified fund because there is going to be some credit risk and some political risk. But those are paying now yields that are, depending on the funds, anywhere between 4 and 7%.
I get what emerging market is. I want to look at whether that's still a good bet. But what's the other category? What does that
high
really
yield.
Mean? High yield as in who? What are you investing
in? High yield
in
means basically
junk
below,
bonds?
Below investment grade. As Diane pointed out, we had spread widening in the junk bond area. So actually, that's a pretty good time to come in.
Do you have to be a zillionaire
You can get $10,000, $5,000 and put it in a high yield fund or put it in an emerging market fund. And you need to be in a fund. You don't want to try to pick these themselves. As I said, there will be defaults. The notion is if you got 100 bonds, even though a few of them are going to default, you're going to come out ahead.
What kind of returns have we seen on these high yield funds?
Well, we're looking at current yields in these funds somewhere in the 4 to 7% range, depending on exactly what quality you're buying and these sorts of things. Now, people say, okay, I'm a little scared of emerging markets because they think, well,
look at China, people talking about a bubble, not only there.
Yeah, but, you know, the reality is if you look at the balance sheets of countries like Brazil and many countries in Asia, they're a lot stronger than the U.S. balance sheet. They have a lot more reserves. And many of these countries, half the countries that used to be considered developing, many of them are now investment grade. So the quality of debt coming out of these countries is much higher. China, by the way, you can't easily buy Chinese debt because mm-hmm. it's not a convertible currency. But look at the countries that where all the growth is. And so, yes, some of them are going to have defaults, but that's why you hold a diversified portfolio.
Diane Swonk, take us to housing for a second here. I mean, Leon called about his own housing situation. It's been terrible, 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 and it continues to be a big drag on the U.S. economy. But are there now opportunities here? Is this if somebody's thinking about going out and buying a home, that they've managed to save enough, interest rates are low enough, they're lucky enough to have a job, they can get a mortgage? Is this a time to buy or?
No, there certainly is opportunities. The question is, how long you're going to stay there. I mean, if you're willing to stay in a home for 10 years, there's a huge opportunity there, and you're going to get a home at a very cheap price and cheaper than you could rent, which I think is another interesting aspect of the U.S. economy today is that we're now overshooting in the housing market for various reasons in credit markets, and it's now gotten cheaper. The owner's cost of owning a home is now cheaper than rents. Rents have gone up quite dramatically. There's a very large demand for people renting single-family homes. It's very hard to be an absentee landlord, to be a landlord on your own home.
Yep.
The bottom line is there is an arbitrage opportunity there. I was just in the epicenter, Newman, California, of the subprime crisis last week, talking to actually some real estate developers out there, and they said, you know, I'm off unemployment. We're building again. We haven't built a home in 4 years, and we're not going to build a single-family home in 4 years, but we're doing apartments now because people need to live somewhere, and there's still household formation, and the rents are going up. And so although they can't sell the homes, they're renting them out, and it's hard. Having renters, things get stolen, and it's
sure.
not easy, but the bottom line is there is an arbitrage opportunity there, and it's why we're starting to see these, you know, television shows. You know, one of the things I monitor, people say, what do you monitor to understand the economy? And mm-hmm. I say, you know, how many are, it used to be flipped at home, you know, to be able to, people
yeah.
nothing about flipping a house, and
nope.
You knew it had gone awry. Well, now it's, you know, find the rental income in your home. And I think that's very important, as there is an arbitrage opportunity there, and there is stuff going on in apartments. In Chicago, it's as easy to convert a very small sort of three flat from a condo.
Yep.
Same number of pages, three pages, to convert it back into an apartment.
Interesting.
And buying things up and doing that.
And people are doing that, converting from condo to apartment rental. Let's in Chicago. Let's go to
properties, not the big ones. The big ones are harder to convert.
Yeah.
You've got to buy more properties in.
Let's get more questions here. Wendy in Clarence, New York. Wendy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is regarding the transition from saving money to retiring. I've been helping my mom look at some options about actually taking her money out of the market, and it seems that something I've come across that seems to be very useful, but most people don't know about it or talk about it easily, is annuities, and especially annuities for women because of their longevity.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could just comment on that, and they seem to be easier vehicles to explain to an older person.
Bob, what advice for Wendy and her mom?
Annuities are definitely an option that should be seriously considered.
Describe how they work for people who aren't clued in yet.
Okay, so there are fixed annuities and variable annuities. In a fixed annuity, what you do is you pay a certain amount of money, and then you get a certain rate of return for the rest of your life. And so those are good. Generally, people don't like to put all their money in a fixed annuity because if they die early, they get nothing and they have no ability to transfer money to their grandchildren. So what I like to have people think about is maybe take half their money and put it in a fixed annuity. And then that gives them some flexibility, but it gives them an additional steady income over and above Social Security.
With what kind of return these days?
Now, that all depends. With interest rates low, you're not getting a great fixed annuity
rate.
Is
that the whole point of a fixed annuity?
At least the answer is, it again, depends on what you need to live on. And
you got to have something. I mean, if it's half a percent.
Yeah. So the other alternative, which I like better, is to have a variable annuity with a floor. And a variable annuity will usually, you can invest it in something like an S&P 500 fund or a diversified dividend fund or this sort of thing. But they will also, the various annuity issuers will say to you, okay, we're going to guarantee you that you won't lose your principal. So you're not going to lose the amount that you put in.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you some downside protection.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it gives you a chance to participate in the upside. So I'd like to see people who are going into retirement put some of their money, not all their money, in one of these annuities.
Diane, I got a whole string of comments here on the market. Joe in Philly writes, golden opportunity, and a big question mark. He says, the risk premium for equities is the only thing that's undervalued in this market. Cash is king. The only ones that will make money are fund managers making ridiculous salaries and bonuses. Joe says, forget the market. Here's another listener says, I get so tired of stock analysts who believe that in the long term, the stock market is all but guaranteed to yield a good return. He says, tell that to the Japanese who have been waiting how long now, Diane? I mean, what if we're in a Japanese situation in this country where it just goes on and on and on and on and on bad?
Well, you know, that's interesting because we've already sort of been in a very similar situation economically.
Just not as long.
Look at our profit situation. It's been very different. And I think that's where the break comes, is that the profit situation has been very different than what the Japanese have said. And the reality is it's because we're not very nice. I mean, you know, we do take cuts. We make cuts, and we...
No lifetime employment guarantee here, no floor.
There's no, you know, I mean, we change a lot of the rules of the game. You know, the whole lifetime unemployment, or employment, I say unemployment now, I hate to slip that was a Freudian slip.
Yep.
The whole lifetime employment guarantees broke down in the 1990s, you know, even for senior executives. I mean, my theory about, we saw in the early 1990s, when Bob Stemple was fired at the helm of General Motors Corporation for signing a bad UAW contract, that shook corporate management suites across the country. So instead of asking for, you know, all of a sudden tenure of CEOs went down, so they asked for 30-year, you know, wages in 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, they got paid very well all of a sudden because their turnover.
That teeny tiny number at the top. Bob, what about this?
Yeah, I'm just saying. I think the two critical things that are distinctive on the U.S. versus Japan are demographics and technology.
We're not as old.
We're not only not as old, we're actually having demographic growth.
Yeah. While they're aging.
Japan is declining in population rapidly.
But and technology, what's our advantage?
The difference is we produce a lot of innovation.
Yeah.
We get a lot of changes.
And apply it.
Japan has been basically a good copier. They've learned to sort of
quality
apply
control,
things
refine
and this
it,
and
it, turn it
but
up.
But it's a high cost place to do business with very little innovation. Those are the two things that make the U.S. different than Japan, and they're really important.
Granted, what about this? Rob says a question for the guests. When the demographic bubble called the baby boomers start to cash in their stocks and there are fewer Gen Xers to invest to keep stock prices high, will the stock market be exposed as a giant Ponzi scheme?
The baby boomlet's bigger, so and the baby boom is going to be. I'm part of the baby boom. I was born in 1962,
okay.
And
baby boomlet's bigger, what jobs do they have?
No, but I think the answer is there's not a cliff here. What there is a slight trough, and then they're actually the next generations are bigger. So it's not like everybody was born in 1946 mm-hmm. and they're all going to retire in the same year. The top of the baby boom was 56, and as Diane says, you had a baby boomlet afterwards. The other thing is, as people perceive themselves as living longer, they're not coming to 65 and cashing totally out of the stock market mm-hmm. because they think they're going to live to 75 or 85 or 90. And so we have a much more gradual approach here.
Let's go to Burlington.
That's really important, too, is that it's an issue we're going to have to deal with Social Security as well. You know, we saw the proposals for 28-year-olds to retire at 68 put forth a little over a year ago in December of last year with the Simpson-Bowles Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people were outraged that 28-year-olds would have 40 years to save for an extra couple years before they retire. And those 28-year-olds are going to live a very long time. So we have to rethink some of these things.
Clearly, there's a lot on the table. Burlington, Vermont, John is calling. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. In the day of Bernie Madoff, 8% was considered maybe how can you possibly do it type thing.
Yeah.
Now, the REITs, that's the Real Estate Reinvestment Trust, are returning 13-14% and have done for the last 2 and 3 years.
Yep.
They're based on the fact that interest rates are low, and as long as they are, they'll do well. And the Fed says the next 2 years are pretty low interest rates, so can this be believed?
Is this nirvana? Can we plunge into the real estate investment trust, Bob Posen, and get a couple more years of, double-digit return? Sounds pretty great for the 1%.
Real estate investment trust, there are a lot of different ones, and so you've got to be careful.
All the same.
they're so different. So the ones that are getting the high returns, some of them have had properties that were well-placed, and they're, as Diane pointed out, have strong rental income. But real estate trust, if you look at them over the last 10 years, they've had a lot of ups and downs. And I don't know the one particular one that the speaker is referring to, but I wouldn't count on a 13-14% return in any real estate trust. There might be some that are good ones, but that sounds a little high to me.
What do you say, Diane?
This gets to the issue. Anyone counting on those kind of returns in this kind of environment is counting on a big risk, right? A big downside risk. And so you got to, again, why are you getting those returns? Because there's a downside risk. I think there's a lot of opportunity in REITs as well, but they're not all the same. And it gets the same thing with municipal bonds, with all different kinds. Not all, top-rated municipal bonds are equal. Not all top-rated corporate bonds are equal, although they're probably more equal than municipal bonds. And I think these are issues that you have to get into is you got to start thinking as an investor rather than investing blindly. And if you want to pay someone to invest for you, you better make sure that you know who they are. We don't deal with anyone, and this isn't just in any area, until we've investigated him first. I mean, we never dealt with Madoff in our firm because we thought he was, we saw what his investment, sheets look like, and they didn't make any sense.
Lucky for you, or good for you, or good sense for you. let me get another caller here, Diane, if I may. Columbia. Columbia, South Carolina. Joe is calling. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's a very interesting program. I'm a baby boomer who's ready for a next career. I'm interested in investing in my own tech company.
Okay.
And I would very much like to use my retirement funds for which I could get a much higher return without having the tax penalty and the other penalties associated with taking those funds out. I'd also like to be able to return those funds back to my account with some earnings in a couple of years. And I think it would be a great federal policy for the President and Congress to free up this capital. Maybe your guests know how much capital is tied up. And I'm not suggesting that everyone should do this, but those of us who could create jobs and really stimulate the economy, as small businesses would, I'd like to hear their reaction to this.
Joe, I appreciate it. Bob Posen, we'll unlock it for our caller, Joe. Let him take his 401k.
Well, there are two things. One is, as a practical matter, you can unlock it. You can take a loan from your 401k plan at a reasonable rate, and then you can take that money and invest it or do anything you want. But the second thing is the reason why the generally pension laws don't favor that approach for the normal person is because you're basically taking what should be a diversified, long-term, relatively conservative investment, and you're betting it all on one company. So if that company does well, that's great. But generally, we try to have people for retirement taking a more diversified and broader approach, not their own company.
Joe's ready to take a flyer on himself as an entrepreneur.
Then he ought to take a loan from his 401k, and he can take that money and invest it in his own company if that's what he wants to do.
Joe, good luck to you. I mean, we see all this, and at the same time, we're fully aware for a lot of people the idea of even having a nest egg to put in somewhere is tough these days. And there is so much skepticism here. Another listener writes, for most of us 99%ers, I think just buying some property, keeping an envelope full of money under the mattress is the best we're going to be able to do. For those with a bit more, find local investment opportunities that actually help contribute to positive local benefit. And this listener writes, screw Wall Street. That attitude is big and wide in the land right now, Diane. I wonder how long that lasts.
I've worked there.
Yeah.
Never have.
Yeah, well, but you know, the whole country kind of just not sure, an awful lot of people, whether they've got the means or really the readiness again to get back in that game. But you've given us some good advice today on how to think about it, at least, as we face this new year. Diane Swonk, Chief Economist at Mesirow Financial, with us today from Evanston, Illinois. Thank you so much for being with us, Diane.
Thank you.
And Robert Posen, former chairman, now senior advisor at MFS Investment Management, author of The Fund Industry. Bob Posen, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Listeners, very good luck to you in 2012. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.